You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
So Planck says that there's a tiny bit less dark energy in the universe than we thought, but it still makes up the biggest component of the universe's energy budget. And it's still a big mystery, as physicists struggle to find out what it is and how it powers the universe outwards against the inward pull of gravity. Measurements of the cosmic microwave background helped to prove that this strange effect is real, but it was first stumbled on many years earlier by two independent teams of astronomers looking at something quite different, the distance to faraway supernova. It was such a groundbreaking discovery that in 2011, the Nobel Prize in Physics was shared between Brian Schmidt at the Australian National University and Adam Rees at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore on one team, and Saul Perlmutter at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, who led the other team. Zia, you recently interviewed each of them for an article in Discover magazine, right?
Yes, that's right. My article about their amazing discovery and what astronomers are doing today to try and pin down its cause is in the May issue of Discover magazine. What was really exciting for me talking to them was to get a sense of how they got their first inkling that they had made, well, either a huge discovery or a gigantic and embarrassing mistake. And once they realised they were onto something big, each group raced to publish their findings before their competitor. Last year, while preparing for the article, I was lucky enough to meet up with Schmidt, who was visiting London because he was being inducted as a Fellow of the Royal Society. He talked to me through the discovery, which had its roots in his childhood interest in astronomy.
So I grew up with parents who I slightly surprised by coming on the scene. They were undergraduates, so they were 19 and 20 when they had me. And my father was studying to be a biologist. So I grew up with the science as he did it. And so I was immersed in science, albeit biology, at a very young age. Astronomy was not something I thought too much about until I was, I think, in second or third grade. There was a Comet West, that came out, and I suddenly saw that the night sky could change and be interesting. And so that, you know, piqued an interest in astronomy. My parents bought me a cheap little telescope. I remember seeing Jupiter. And so astronomy was always something I was interested thereon after.
You know, you sort of said that you were always interested in astronomy. Did growing up in Alaska make a difference? Because I would imagine you could see the sky just beautifully there.
Actually, Alaska's a challenging place to do astronomy because during the summer it never gets dark, and during the winter it's colder than hell. The good part of it was aurora, so the thing that I was really interested in Alaska was seeing all the northern lights. I started getting into calculating the orbit of the moon and trying to, you know, predict solar eclipses, and so one of the first things I programmed when I was learning computers about 1981 or something, so I would have been 14. Computers were just coming out. We got one of the first IBM PCs, my dad did, and so I started learning how to program. And so one of the first things I programmed was how to calculate eclipses. It took me about 2 years to figure out how to do it.
In 2011, Schmidt was awarded a share of the Nobel Prize in Physics for the discovery that the expansion of the universe is accelerating. He shared the prize with team member Adam Rees, now at Johns Hopkins University, and with Saul Perlmutter of the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, who led a rival study that made the same startling finding. The techniques the teams used built on the groundbreaking work of astronomers Edwin Hubble and Vesto Melvin Slipher in the first half of the 20th century, which first revealed that the universe is expanding.
1916, Vesto Melvin Slipher went through and he measured the redshift of galaxies. Redshift is how much their light has been shifted to the red or to the blue by what he would describe at the time by their velocity, by the Doppler shift. And in 1916, Slipher realized that almost all the galaxies, which he didn't even know what galaxies were at the time, were moving, their spectra was shifted to the red. So it was like every object was moving away from us. Edwin Hubble went out and decided to measure the distances to these galaxies. And in astronomy, it's very hard to measure distances because you just can't lay down rulers between us and the nearest galaxy. And so what he decided to do was to look at how bright stars were in the nearest galaxy. Now, since the time of Newton, we've known that the further away an object is, the fainter it appears. It drops as the square of the distance. The brightness of an object drops as the square. So imagine I look at a star in a nearby galaxy and compare it to the star in a distant galaxy. The star in the distant galaxy will appear fainter if those stars are the same brightness. So as astronomers, you're desperate. And so Hubble said, well, let's just assume all the stars in all galaxies, the brightest ones, are the same brightness. And that's probably a reasonable approximation. It is. It's good to factors of 10. So he was able to look at how bright stars were in all these galaxies, and what he found was the fainter the stars were in the galaxy, that is, the further away the galaxy was, the more the galaxy was redshifted. And that is what he announced in 1929 meant that the universe was expanding. Because the further away something is, the faster it's moving. And if I take, for example, a balloon and I put little stars on it and I blow the balloon up, as I blow the balloon up, every star moves away from every other star. The further away the stars are, the faster the stars move apart as I blow that balloon out. So it's just like what Hubble was seeing in our own galaxy. So if you look back in time by looking a long ways away, light takes billions of years to reach us from, you know, a long ways away, from a billion light years in distance. You can go through and do what Hubble did by looking back in time. You can measure distance and redshift back in time.
Neither team expected to find that the universe's expansion was speeding up. Einstein's general theory of relativity predicted that the expansion should actually be slowing down as matter is pulled back inwards by the gravity of other matter in the cosmos. Both teams hoped that by measuring the rate of this predicted deceleration, they would learn other exciting facts about the fate of the universe.
Now, it turns out that Hubble's ideas we understand through general relativity, so Einstein's theory of gravity. And general relativity makes very specific predictions about the universe's past. That is, the trajectory that the universe takes ultimately depends on what is in the universe, how much, and how it behaves. So back in 1994, when we started our project, life was very simple. The only thing in the universe was stuff like you and me and dark matter, which we're not going to talk about. But it, for gravity's sake, it behaves exactly the same. And there was a one-to-one correspondence. The more stuff there was in the universe, the faster the universe would slow down over time. And there was a critical density of material in the universe where the universe would eventually stop its expansion and then go into reverse. That amount of deceleration was a very interesting number because space is curved, and under a universe that only has the stuff in it, then you can also use how fast the universe is slowing down to tell you the shape of the universe. If you're above this critical density, space wraps around onto itself and the universe is finite. So it was a huge question to ask. By measuring what the universe was doing back in time, we could figure out if the universe was infinite or finite, and essentially that's about as big a question as you can imagine. Does the universe last forever or does it eventually end? It's a pretty important question.
Edwin Hubble's earlier measurements of the expansion of the universe had only been approximate. To make better measurements that could tell us the fate of the universe, astronomers needed to find celestial objects that could act as more accurate yardsticks in the sky. They turned to supernovae, the bright explosions that mark the end of a star's life.
Now, type 1a supernovae are these exploding stars of a white dwarf. So a white dwarf is the end state of our sun after it burns all its hydrogen and helium. This core part of it will collapse down to something about the size of the Earth, but it will have the mass of about 60% of the sun's current mass. So stuff's amazingly dense. A teaspoon weighs a ton. Now that stuff, Chandrasekhar, who ultimately won a Nobel Prize for this and other things, demonstrated that as you add material to a white dwarf, the more material you add, the smaller it gets. So it's kind of funny. It's not like if you add material to the Earth gets bigger. You add a material to a white dwarf, it gets smaller. And that's because the gravity is pushing against the electrons, which push back. As you add more and more gravity, the electrons kind of get squeezed a bit. And at 1.38 times the mass of our sun, the electrons can push back no more. And just before that point, it turns out, the nuclear reactions of the carbon and oxygen in the center of one of these stars ignite like a blasting cap and cause, slowly at first and then running away within a period of a second at the very end, the whole thing explodes as a giant thermonuclear bomb. So these things, you can imagine, are interesting because they're going to explode at a certain very characteristic time in a star's life. These are what we call type 1a supernovae. And when you go out and look at them, they're not exactly the same, but they're quite similar. And by observing how fast they rise in brightness and fall, that tells us how bright they are, how many watts they emit. So by looking at how bright they appear, we can measure their distance. We can measure their distance to about 6%. And so with them, we are able to measure distances back 10 billion years in the past, we can do right now. We can measure their redshifts, that is how much their light had been stretched by the expanding universe. And that enabled us, through Einstein's theory of gravity, to predict the ultimate future of the universe and its past, essentially.
Does that sort of bring us to the actual project that you're famous for?
It's all part of the same story. I started my PhD in 1989, and I was working on type 2 supernovae. These are the explosions of massive stars, probably 10 or 20 times bigger than our sun. And these things explode when they run out of nuclear energy. And I was using them to measure the Hubble constant, how fast the universe is expanding now. When I finished that, I did that for my PhD thesis. I finished my PhD thesis in 1993. From the science side, I was looking for something interesting to do. And in 1994, two things happened. A group in Chile, the Kalantololo survey, so that's Nick Sunseff, Mario Hemwe, Mark Phillips, and Jose Maza, went through and finished the first part of the really important fundamental basis of type 1a supernovae. They went out and used this class of objects, and they took digital data of a lot of objects for the first time. And when they did that, they showed that these things are not all the same. They differ, that all type 1a supernovae are not the same. You can't use them as a standard candle like we had wanted to, where you say they're all the same brightness. You have to calibrate them. But when you do that calibration, they are really good, much better than we had ever thought they might be. So it turns out they were good to about measuring distances of 6% accuracy. And I had been pretty skeptical about these type 1a supernovae until I saw that work. And I was like, wow, they're a lot better than I thought they ever could be.
It was at this point that Adam Riess and Sol Perlmutter, who shared the Nobel Prize with Schmidt, entered the story, along with other colleagues of Schmidt's. Together, they realized that type 1a supernovae could be spotted out to far farther distances than previously thought.
The other thing that happened, about a month later, Bob Kirshner, Adam Riess, and Peter Chow, so Adam Riess is a graduate student 3 years behind me, and I was a postdoc now, and they were out on the telescope, and Sol called up and said, I've got an object for you to look at. They had some time, so they looked at it, and I received an email and the spectrum in the morning with a little note saying, hey, this looks like a type 1a supernova, but at a redshift of 0.42. And so I ran it through some machinery to see where it was, and I agreed. It was honestly a type 1a supernova at this very large distance, 10 times further than we normally see them, or 5 times further than we normally see them. And then it emerged, as we were discussing this object with them, that they had discovered 7 of these in the previous 3 months. So in a period of 1 month, I went from thinking doing anything in the distant universe with type 1 supernova was just pointless. They were hard to find and they didn't measure very good distances, to suddenly realizing they measure really good distances and they're not that hard to find. So we, being a royal we, discussed with Sol what to do with this object. We had a spectrum, he had obviously discovered it and doing stuff. And it became very clear to me that he had a fundamental different way of looking at how to do the experiment. And if we wanted to, you know, express ourselves scientifically on how to do this experiment, we were going to have to do our own. So the program was born there in 1994.
You know, you mentioned that you wanted to follow a different kind of path to the one that Sol was suggesting. So what did you want to do and why was that different?
So the supernova community had, you know, studied supernovae a lot. And so we were worried about how they might change back in time. We were really worried about dust. So the universe is full of dust. And dust, turns out, absorbs light. So what happens if I look at a supernova and there's dust between me and the supernova? That'll make that supernova look fainter. Now, I've just said how bright a supernova is going to be how I measure its distance. So there, I can get confused between dust and distance. And we were really worried about this. Turns out dust in the universe is not that dissimilar to dust in our atmosphere. So when you look at the sun on a dusty day, the sun appears red. And that's because the blue light has been scattered by the dust. If you were to think of it, the sun has been reddened, as we would say in astronomy. It's been made to look redder. And the more and more dust you have, the redder and redder the sun would appear. Supernovae the same way. Got a little bit of dust, it makes them a little redder. You got a lot of dust, it makes them even more redder. Now, this redder, it's subtracting light away. It's not stretching the light to the red. It's actually subtracting light, so you can see the difference between it. So we were really worried about this. And so we immediately set out to measure, you know, the colors of these supernovae, and it was very expensive to do that. And we also were very worried about just the details of how to measure how bright the objects were very, very carefully. That was something we were very experienced in, and we weren't convinced they were doing it correctly. I wasn't saying they were doing it incorrectly. I'm saying we could not be sure, and we were not being allowed to participate in a way where we could, in our opinion, feel that these things were being addressed properly. So those are the things we wanted to deal. Ultimately, Saul wanted to do the experiment his way, and that's fine. And he didn't want us just to hop in and do it our way. And we wanted to do it our way and not be sidetracked by his views. So it was, you know, two groups had quite different cultures. You know, he came from particle physics. We came from astronomy. His group, very hierarchical. One person on top, two people down, four. We're just sort of a morass. You know, our team, a bunch of astronomers drinking beer together, and although I was the leader, it wasn't like I was in charge. You know, there's a difference.
The discovery that something was apparently pushing the universe outwards was not immediate for either of the competing teams. After analyzing the first batch of data, Schmidt's team saw slight hints that the expansion of the universe was unexpectedly speeding up against the predictions of standard physics. But the effect was not big enough to be conclusive. At the same time, however, Sol Perlmutter's group released a paper saying that the universe's expansion was slowing down, as expected by standard physics. The seeming mismatch between the two groups' findings deeply troubled Schmidt.
But in 1997, in September, Sol's team put out a paper saying the universe is slowing down quite a lot from their first seven objects. So we were worried, and as a team, we went through huge machinations in September about, are we sure about what we're doing? And it was a bit ugly, but we worked through them in September of what to do.
It was Schmidt's colleague, Adam Rees, who saw their team's first definitive signs of dark energy as he began to analyze the second batch of data. Rees had written a computer program that was designed to chew over the data and spit out an estimate for the mass of the universe. His program worked on the assumption that the universe only contains simple things like matter, but no dark energy type component. When he plugged in the data, however, his program told him somewhat nonsensically that the mass of the universe was negative. Rees realized this simply did not make physical sense. Instead, he suspected the only way to get the data to add up correctly would be to include a new energy component, now dubbed dark energy, that pushed the universe outwards. This outward push would have to account for about 70% of the universe's energy budget. The implication was so bizarre that Schmidt, at first, assumed the results must be a mistake.
I could see what was going on just by eye. I immediately said, oh boy, what have we done wrong? So there started quite an intense exchange about going through all of the bits and pieces in the experiment one by one, checking the photometry. But in the end, we went through all the pieces bit by bit, and on the 8th of January in Australia, Adam and I agreed on every piece of the calculation. We had gone through and literally piece by piece done everything, and our codes got the exact same answer on everything. So at that point I said, okay, I'm ready to sign off on this now.
Eventually, after further analysis, both teams reached the same conclusion and announced their findings. The universe, it seemed, had a new component, dark energy. This strange stuff was pushing the universe outwards and causing the expansion of the universe to accelerate. Now they had to sit back and await the world's response, which was a mixture of excitement and disbelief.
I have to admit, I knew it was going to be a kind of a big deal. I figured people were going to be, just be skeptical, very, very skeptical. And so I knew it would be interesting. I hadn't really expected it to go completely crazy in the U.S. It received almost no coverage in Australia, but it was heavily covered in the United States with CNN going and, you know, live interview of Adam Riess from Berkeley. And the other part I hadn't predicted was how warmly received it would be from the theorist side of the community. The observers were skeptical. The acceleration had come into vogue many times in the past, always because people had screwed up. Now, I was pretty sure we had not screwed up the measurements, but that is, the supernovae were too faint at their redshift to be explained by anything reasonable. But I was worried something hadn't been thought of by everyone and that it might go away for reasons to be determined. So I was worried, but it, as I said, got a much warmer reception than I expected. I expected people to be skeptical. I would have been skeptical. I was skeptical.
So when you did go public with it, you must have had these conflicting emotions about, on the one hand, you're sort of competing with another group, and on the other hand, you don't want to make a fool of yourself by announcing, you know, just something that's just really, really badly wrong.
Well, I have to admit, when I thought the other team was getting that the universe was slowing down very quickly and we were getting it was speeding up, I was concerned because I felt we had done everything correctly and I was willing to swear by our results. But I knew the community, given an absurd result and one they expected, we had the absurd result, we were going to be in trouble. So I will say, when we saw at the beginning of January that Saul was essentially getting the same answer as us, I felt pretty relieved. It was an intense competition, and I have to admit, I wasn't too worried about getting there first, but I was worried about being there last, if that makes sense. Yeah, you don't want to do something wrong. I felt, in the end, I'm a scientist, and I felt we had done the experiment correctly. So I felt very strongly about that. I was more worried about people's reactions to it.
So at the time, you know, did you foresee how big this was? Maybe that seems silly, because obviously you knew that it was a strange and interesting result, but, you know, it's still with us. People are still just perplexed. Yeah.
So at the time, I knew if it withstood the test of time, it was a big result. That it was a crazy thing, it would be huge if it withstood the test of time. I felt there was a reasonable chance that something, not our fault, something would come up in astrophysics where people say, forgot about this, and it would somehow go away. But knowing everything I knew at the time, I could not come up with anything. So I felt it was important to tell the world about it and open up it to discussion. Now, it would have been really embarrassing if we had, you know, missed a factor of pi and we had just instantly been shown to be wrong. But I felt we had dealt with everything like that. I was confident, I was willing to risk my own reputation to say we have done this experiment correctly. The other thing that happened in the year 2000 is the first cosmic microwave background experiments came along that demonstrated that the universe had flat geometry to within 10%. Now, once that measurement was made, our measurement of the acceleration went from being sort of 4 or 5 standard deviation measurement to like 9. I suddenly, at that point, I remember thinking, wow, we're actually right. So at that point, I think I wasn't the only one who felt this. All the work came how to explain the dark energy. So there was a real change of focus from disproval, I would say, before that, to suddenly, wow, we got to deal with this.
Did you think at that point Nobel Prize?
No, I didn't really expect to get the Nobel Prize. One of these things, you know, people were talking about the Nobel Prize. Well, in science, people talk about the Nobel Prize all the time. And I have met many, many people who thought they were going to win the Nobel Prize who are dead now. And you don't know. My view was the Nobel Prize Committee could easily think, we will think about giving this a prize when we understand what it is. In which case, I felt unlikely we would ever get one. And that's fine. On the other hand, I think it's great that they thought this was important enough, just the acceleration itself, even though we don't understand it, that that was an important enough thing to celebrate. So I feel honored, but I certainly didn't expect it. For me, it's kind of interesting to be born at this right time of where technology allowed us to discover these type 1a supernovae and figure out that they work. But, you know, this has been a fundamental quest since 1915 or, you know, when Einstein's theory came out. And one of the great things about being part of this is it's been really an astronomy activity. It has involved a huge fraction of the world's astronomers at some point of their career over time. And so it's quite exciting to, you know, sort of be at the business end of all this work. But on the other hand, one of the great things I think about the Nobel Prize has been how genuinely excited astronomers have been about the prize, because I think everyone feels it's part theirs, because it is. It is built up on an entire community. And so that's why a Nobel Prize is so exciting, is it really is a celebration where the world celebrates 100 years of cosmology is effectively what it's celebrating.
That was Brian Schmidt remembering his Nobel-winning discovery of dark energy in the late 1990s. You can read more about that and astronomers' current attempts to home in on what dark energy is through planned space missions in the May issue of Discover magazine.
And don't forget to mention that you can also follow Brian Schmidt on Twitter at CosmicPinot. That's CosmicPinot.